Hello, I'm Brett Dillon, and this is The Movie Chronicles. Today's episode hops through Europe, from Britain to France to Italy, as we examine the responses to World War II in these countries. I open in Britain with A Matter of Life and Death, director Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, director of photography Jack Cardiff, editor Reginald Mills, music Alan Gray. Actors, David Niven, Kim Hunter, Robert Coote, Richard Attenborough, Marius Goering, Roger Livesley, Raymond Massey, Robert Beatty, John Logden, Lewis Maxwell, Lawrence Payne, Robert Riety, and Eric Cawthorne. A movie about death is a strange choice for release during World War II. On paper, this looks like bad taste. Emmerich Pressburger manages to construct a tasty fairy tale from such unpromising material. Even across this gulf of time and distance, I can hear the howls of outrage at describing this tale as a fairy tale. Powell and Pressburger open this film with a disclaimer that the story is not meant to fit any religious paradigm. It is the story of a diseased mind. They present heaven as having a commonality with Orwell's 1984 and are very careful to keep mentions of heaven to a minimum. The anachronistic spirits with their magical time-stopping powers are analogous to fairies. Under American hands, the story would be twee. I refer you to Heaven Can Wait, 1943. Powell does not tie his hands with a concrete vision of heaven or hell. Instead, he explores this notion as a state of mind. The film begins with a sequence that would be the finale of many another film of the period. Sequence after sequence tops it, of which my favourite is a crossfade from a black and white to a colour garden and the camera obscura introduction to the village. All the heaven sequences are in black and white, with a modernist look, utilitarian and functional, but not architecture you could warm to. The black and white is something of an inside joke. Production was delayed for 9 months due to the wartime difficulty of obtaining Technicolor film. The whole film was shot on Technicolor film, but no dyes were used in processing the film for the black and white sequences, so that there was, therefore, no colour. The Earth sequences feel more Victorian, cluttered and clumsily human with lived-in spaces. The plot has an RAF pilot survive a fall without a parachute from his burning plane. In hospital, he falls in love until a messenger from heaven arrives to tell him there has been a mistake and he was supposed to die in the fall. He protests that, as he has contracted new responsibilities as a result of this error, he should be allowed a new life. Back on Earth, we find the airman has a brain disease which, if not operated upon shortly, will kill him. Heaven puts the matter to arbitration using a Brit-hating soldier from the War of Independence as prosecution. Michael Powell cast then-unknown actress Kim Hunter on the advice of Alfred Hitchcock. The film encountered some problems in the USA as the distributors felt a movie with death in the title would be box office poison. They renamed the film Stairway to Heaven after the huge escalator seen in the film. This was named by the crew Operation Ethel. It took 3 months to build, had 106 steps, and was driven by a 12-horsepower motor so loud the dialogue for the scenes had to be done in post-production. DOP Jack Cardiff was born on September the 18th, 1914, in Great Yarmouth, England, and he died in 2009. Jack was born to music hall parents who had no problems putting him on the stage. At 15 in 1929, he started working for British International Pictures as camera assistant, clapper boy, and production runner. In 1935, he became a camera operator and cinematographer for London Films. In 1943, Jack began a collaboration with Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger as second unit cameraman on The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp. they moved him up as director of photography for the next series of films. 1958 was the year he graduated to director with Intent to Kill. He achieved fame with Sons and Lovers, 1960, which won 7 Oscars, and Cardiff received a Golden Globe for Best Director. From the 70s onwards, he concentrated on cinematography. Of the craft of directing, Jack Cardiff is quoted as saying, "Most directors who have been around for a while acquire a gaunt, soul-scarred look associated with fighter pilots who have survived a war." Actor Robert Riety was born on February 8, 1924, in Paddington, England, and he died in 2015. Robert was honoured by the Italian government for his service to Italian theatre and film, not unconnected to his actual name being Lucio Herbert Riety. He was placed in an internment camp during World War II because of his Italian origins. Robert overdubbed parts of Orson Welles' performance in Treasure Island, 1972, and Christopher Plummer in The Royal Hunt of the Sun, 1969. He was also involved in overdubs for the restoration of David Lean's Lawrence of Arabia, 1962. He is the only other actor, the first is Sean Connery, to appear in both Thunderball, 1965, and its remake, Never Say Never, 1983. History bounced around the old noggin on January the 10th. The United Nations met for the first time. The meeting was held at the Methodist Central Hall, London, England. January the 16th. Charles de Gaulle resigned as head of the French Provisional Government. March the 5th. At a speech in Westminster College, Fulton, Missouri, USA, Winston Churchill first publicly used the phrase Iron Curtain to describe the deteriorating situation between Russia and Europe. May the 9th, King Victor Emmanuel III of Italy abdicated. Hail his son, King Umberto II. June the 2nd, Italy conducted the first election that allowed women to vote. The burning issue was whether to replace the monarchy or not. June the 5th. The bikini was first modelled in Paris, France. It was atomic, and we still live in its afterglow. September the 1st. The first official Formula One race was held in Turin, Italy. Details are shrouded. December the 12th, Leon Blum formed a coalition of socialist parties to form the new government of France. Skipping across the English Channel, we arrive in time for La Bataille du Rail, the Battle of the Rails. Director and script, René Clément. Script, Colette Audry. Director of photography, Henri Alican. Editor, Jacques Desagneaux. Music, Yves Baudrier. Actors, Marcel Banot, Jean Calario, Jean Durand, Lucien Desagno, Pierre Latour, and Charles Boyer. With France freed from Nazi occupation, the French government were keen to reverse the international perception that the French had capitulated to and collaborated with the Nazis far too easily. The film was financed from the former resistance, who wanted to show France had kept up the fight behind the lines. In particular, it was the railway workers who sabotaged Nazi plans. The propaganda is obvious. One of the directors taking note of this film was David Lean, who refers to it in his production of Lawrence of Arabia, 1962. Although I also note that the French resistance in this film don't seem to be using Lawrence's technique of rail demolition. He used his explosives to move the rail to the side, which necessitated replacing up to 1 kilometer of rail. The French seem to be placing the explosives to push the rail up, which would result in only needing to replace a rail or two. We open in June 1940 with posters ordering that Jews are forbidden. The setting in the railway is linking the transport of Jews to the death camps, and this situation is being analogous to France under the Nazis. This is a bold, historically inaccurate statement that the producers could only have gotten away with in this moment of time. It should also be noted that director of photography Henri Alleken was a survivor of a death camp. René Clermont cast actual rail workers and resistance fighters in his films. This has seen it associated with the post-war Italian neorealist movement. For René, however, the technique was but a continuation of his pre-war documentary works. The style is docudrama, and its set-piece battle is ripped from the pages of history. Having established the era, the first act of the film is a how to engage in railway sabotage, from smuggling resistance fighters along the track to the committing of little errors that magnify over time to bring the system to a halt. Mistransmissions of information so the timings are all out, bringing the line to a halt until the confusion is cleared. Hiding items on trains, misdirecting carriages to the wrong locations, and even sabotaging the cargo itself. The Germans respond with Teutonic savagery. Saboteurs are executed. This neither wins them friends nor influences people. Although the tone of the film is generally neutral to Germans as a people, it is very against their mechanical militancy. The Germans are shot in a disfavorable light whenever they behave like machines, but are humanized by humorous reaction shots as they realize their plans are being waylaid by seemingly random events. The second act begins when the rail workers learn of the Normandy invasion through their secret radio. It now becomes vital to organize with the resistance. This leads to the derailment of a troop train, an actual train, not a model shot, and a suicide mission by the resistance to hold up the transport of some tanks. Director René Clermont was born on March the 18th, 1913, in Bordeaux, France, and he died in 1996. René studied architecture at the École des Beaux-Arts and then developed an interest in filmmaking. In 1936, he released a short film which starred Jacques Tati. René then vanished. Not really. He was in the Middle East making documentaries with archaeologist Jules Bafour. Through the period of the Nazi occupation of France, he continued to make documentaries, which resulted in 1945's La Bataille d'Arles, a story about the French resistance. When World War II ended, and as a victim of two world wars, it should come as no surprise that, as a director, René wanted to make sense of this. The process began with 1945's La Bataille d'Arles, followed by Les Maudits, The Damned, 1947, Jeux Interdits, and Is Paris Burning, both from 1966. The 50s was René's Oscar-winning period. The late 40s and 50s saw him become a darling of international film. By the 60s, however, his style was considered to be somewhat old hat. When the expensive epic Is Paris Burning, 1966, became box office poison, it almost looked like his career was over. René bided his time and fought back in the 70s when the tide of commercial filmmaking had turned back in his direction. Director Henri Alleken was born on February the 10th, 1909, in Paris, France, and he died in 2001. Henri and his brother hit the road in 1925 as traveling puppeteers. All the puppets were given a big hand. Henri soon shifted careers to work as third assistant cameraman at Ballancourt Studios. This career was interrupted by military service. Ballancourt welcomed him back in 1931. In the early 30s, he was associated with DOP Eugène Schuften, who was collaborating with director Marcel Carnet. He didn't get promoted to director of photography until the Battle of the Rails, 1946. The same year, he took on the surrealist classic Les Belles et les Bêtes for Jean Cocteau. By the early 50s, Henri found himself out of sync with the French New Wave movement and shifted to Hollywood, who were more conventional and thus to his taste. His major productions of this period were, however, shot in Europe, leading to his masterwork, Wings of Desire, 1987. When asked what a DOP did, he replied, "To obtain psychological reactions out of mere technical means." Berths battled on. On. January the 1st, Alfonso Curiana, the Italian mobster. He had to make an offer his mother would not refuse. January the 26th, Michel Depeche, the French actor. February the 5th, Charlotte Rampling, the British actor. February the 21st, Vito Rizzato, the Italian-Canadian mobster. He just shot his way out. March the 5th, Lova Moore, the French singer. March the 19th, Steve Halliwell, the British actor. June the 5th, Stefania Sandrali, the Italian actor. October the 2nd, Marie-Georges Pascal, the French actor. Also on October the 2nd, Charles Dance, the British actor. December the 14th, Jane Birkin, the British actor. The scene shifts to an Italy devastated by war. A new civilization has to emerge from the rubble. Paisa, also known as Paisan. Director and script, Roberto Rossellini. Script, Sergio Amadei, Federico Fellini, and Rod E. Geiger. Director of photography, Otello Mattelli. Editor, Eraldo da Roma. Music, Renzo Rossellini. Actors, Camallo Sazio, Robert Van Loon, Dots Johnson, Alfonsino Pasca, Maria Michi, Gar Moore, Harriet Medden, and Guilio Panicali. Paisa, or Paisan, is a slang term created during the liberation of Italy and usually used as an expression meaning buddy or friend. The film is composed of six stories that follow the liberation of Italy during World War II, with a chorus line, "This happened in the winter of 1944. By the beginning of spring, the war was over." The film has two purposes. The propaganda purpose is to rewrite recent Italian history to gain sympathy from the Americans to get finance for reconstruction. The theme is to show how Italian-American relations create misunderstandings that lead to tragedy. My favorite story has three army chaplains arrive at a monastery. All goes well until the friars learn two of the chaplains are spawn of Satan, a Protestant and a Jew. Next favorite has a drunken soldier in Rome. Some children are arguing over who will rob him. When the MPs arrive, the smallest seizes the day and the soldier's hand and leads them away from trouble. After some adventures, they end up having a conversation resting on a pile of rubble, which ends with the boy saying, "Joe, if you fall asleep, I will steal your boots." The screen fades to black. A few days later, the soldier is an MP on patrol. He sees the boy hitching a ride on the back of a truck. He takes the boy down and, in conversation, realizes this is the boy who stole his boots. He demands to see the boy's parents to get his boots back. The boy leads him to a community of the homeless and the catacombs and admits both parents died in the bombing. The soldier staggers away, too stunned by the size of this disaster. Honorable mention goes to another two-hander. A prostitute takes a soldier up to a room where he is unable to perform. He is still in love with an Italian girl he met earlier in the war. We, the audience, know the prostitute is that girl. Antonioni made a 9-minute sequence in one of his films from the finale of this story. The acting from the American cast is not good, but this highlights how good the Italians are. It is worth enduring for the pleasure of the stories. Roberto Rossellini had been encouraged to make a film about the Italian resistance to overturn US propaganda that Italians were all fascists. The film was funded from US and Italian sources, which is a bit peculiar as the US propaganda idea was pushing the idea that the US and the US alone had freed Italy. The US supplied the film stock and four US actors. Italian critics viewed the finished product with suspicion for a mix of political and religious reasons, while overseas critics were enthusiastic. Henri Bazin, for instance, was quickly claiming it as a key film of the Italian neorealist movement. Film historians now regard the film as one of the peaks of film history, while the general public never named this film in polite conversation. It certainly deserves to be more widely seen. Director Roberto Rossellini was born on May 8, 1906, in Rome, Italy, and he died in 1977. Roberto's father built the first cinema in Rome, the Barberini. As a result, his son had a free pass to all screenings. He grew up rejecting religion, but in his films, he explored Catholic ethics and sentiment, as he found religious revelation was something being neglected in the materialist world, which I see as partly a rejection of the materialism of fascism and partly a rejection of the consumerism of the USA. When his father died, Roberto took up various jobs within the Italian film industry, mastering them all. He shot his first film in 1937, but at the moment this is believed to be lost. As a close friend of Vittorio Mussolini, son of Benito, he was getting work with some of the top directors in film productions inside Italy at this time. As a director, his early career has been characterized by critics as a sequence of trilogies. The first trilogy has been called the Fascist Trilogy, 1941-43, as these films were funded by the party. The next series was the one which brought him to international attention. This is called the Neorealist Trilogy, 1945-48. This is the period when Roberto was most interested in working with non-actors. He said, "In order to really create the character that one has in mind, it is necessary for the director to engage in a battle with his actor, which usually ends with submitting to the actor's wish. Since I do not have the desire to waste my energy in battle like this, I only use professional actors occasionally." Roberto would rewrite his scripts to reflect the personal histories of his actors. His use of regional dialects, accents, and costumes are what made an impression on contemporary audiences. For this, director François Truffaut dubbed Roberto the father of the French New Wave. Roberto now shot two films called the Transitional Films, 1948-52, where he examined if cinema could actually portray truth. He noted, "I tried to capture reality, nothing else." In 1948, he got a letter from actor Ingrid Bergman, resulting in one of the most famous love stories of the next decade. Ingrid was writing because she wanted to work with Roberto, having seen some of his earlier films. The romance began as an affair while filming Stromboli, 1950. Thus began the Bergman sequence, 1950-54. The sequence ended in 1957 when Roberto couldn't keep his penis in his trousers. He was invited to India to help kickstart a flailing Indian film industry and had a public affair with actor Sonali Sandroy Dasgupta, who was also married. Due to the controversy, he was invited to leave India. Ingrid Bergman formally separated from her husband. Of his career, Roberto had this to say, "I do not want to make beautiful films, I want to make useful films." Director of photography Otello Mattali was born on May the 19th, 1902, in Rome, Italy, and he died in 2000. Otello began work as an assistant cameraman at the age of 13. He was a fully-fledged cameraman at the age of 16. International fame came his way in the 40s, where his work was a highlight of the neorealist movement. By the 50s, he had become Fellini's favourite cameraman and, at times, a butt for his jokes. Deaths dive-bombed the world. On February the 5th, George Arliss, the British actor, born 1868. April the 22nd, Lionel Atwill, the British actor, born 1885. August the 10th, Léon Gaumont, the French film pioneer, born 1864. September the 29th, Raimu, the French actor, born 1883. December the 12th, René Falconetti, the French actor, born 1892. Next episode continues a war theme. I'll be celebrating Anzac Day with a quick tour of the Boer War. Keep a weather eye out for Movie Chronicles 2020 and Movie Chronicles 2019, available at an e-store near you. Become a Patreon or Buzzsprout supporter to get all the juicy bonus material. I've just thrown another special on the Barbie just for you guys. Until next time, remember Rule 303. It just might save your life.